et nous at kumbit.org ou par courriel at info@kumbit.org. KOUMBIT.org. On n'est pas sur Facebook.
Hello and welcome to CKUT 90.3 FM. We are on John Abbott on the air, and I'm your host, Ekaterina Glukova. And for today's week, we are going to interview Alexey Glukov, who is a 3D modeler for video games. Hello, Alexey.
Hi.
So, first question. When and what interests you to start 3D modeling?
I'm not sure. I guess I've been interested in that since my childhood. I've been a fan of video games, and I always wanted to create my own, and that's why I chose my career path, I suppose.
What styles of video games do you model for?
All kinds of games, and it's not just 3D games that I model for. I also do some sprite work for 2D games, I guess mostly action games. We made some games that were more towards climate activism. That was really interesting to get into, and it was been nice to work with the people that were involved.
How many games have you modeled for?
It hasn't been that many. Mostly it's been for school and certain competitions. It's certainly below 15. I don't claim to have that much experience just yet. I'm still learning, but I guess a lot of the professionals in this line of work can say the same thing.
Do you like to make games alone or with a group?
Creating games alone is possible, but not advised. It's a big undertaking. Imagine if one person would have built a building all by themselves. It's kind of the same thing. So mostly I like to work in a team where tasks can be distributed, and also you meet some nice people along the way.
What competitions do you go to?
I've done a university competition for Ubisoft, but mostly it's locally organized competitions. A lot of the schools in Montreal organize them, Concordia, McGill. Now that COVID is here, it's going to stop for a little bit, but they're going to come back eventually.
With what game did you win?
We made a game about a sailor trying to come back to port. One player controlled the sailor and his ship, and the other player controlled the lighthouse, which was supposed to guide, to light the way for the sailor to come back to port. And we won the award for the best multiplayer aimed game. So that was a lot of fun, and we got some nice prizes out of it as well.
How many people were in your team, and how long did it take to create?
So the event was actually only a 3-day event. It was a game jam. Basically how those work is that you're given a 48-hour window to create a video game from start to finish. Obviously nobody expects that game to be amazing or lengthy, but you do what you can. Our team was 8 people, which is a larger team than usual for these kind of events. Usually you have a 3 or 4 person team, or some people even work in pairs or alone. So it's been a little bit of a challenge to manage this many people, but we pulled through and we won.
What are some of the things you hate in 3D modeling, or modeling in general?
Without getting technical, I guess it's the inspiration. Sometimes you sit down in front of your computer and you just don't feel inspired, or you start to model something and it's not coming together. Some days are better than others. The same can be said, I guess, for any creative profession. And any person in that profession would understand what I'm trying to say.
With COVID around, what do you think will happen to these competitions? And will they ever come back? Or will it be more of an online thing?
I believe they're going to go online for a little bit, but as COVID dies down, and obviously I'm expecting a vaccine to be released sometime, after that I believe they're going to come back, and I'm sincerely hoping and expecting them to.
What advice would you give to people who are just starting out in 3D modeling?
I think the best advice is to not be discouraged. It's a very It's a big field. There's a lot to learn, and it's an ever-changing field as well. There's a lot of professionals in the field who are continuously learning, and sometimes it can be a little bit discouraging knowing that, hey, maybe the stuff that you learned 2, 3 years ago might be obsolete or on its way out. But if you're interested in this sort of thing in 3D modeling game creation, you're expected to be passionate about it. So I don't believe that a lot of people would necessarily have this problem down the line. It's just in the beginning, I would say, don't get discouraged and push on.
Thank you so much, Alexei, for being our guest today and spending your time with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Alexei Glukov, who is a 3D modeler for video games. This was John Abbott on the air on CKUT 90.3 FM, and this was your host, Ekaterina Glukova, signing out.
This is Ryan Young with CKUT 90.3 FM, and I'm here with Alanis Obabsawin, who is a documentary filmmaker working for the National Film Board of Canada. And she is Abenaki, and she has produced probably, of any filmmaker in Canada, the largest body of work about Indigenous issues in Canada. And her latest film is We Can't Make the Same Mistake Twice, which is all about the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal's judgment and complaint, which led to the judgment that Canada was basically breaking its own laws by not providing the same level of social services for Indigenous children in the system. So, Alanis, you were here at John Abbott College today to speak. You spoke a lot about your life. I didn't know you were 84 years old.
I sure am.
And you look great. And you have so much energy. It was really touching to hear about some of your early life experiences. Tell me a little bit about growing up in Odenak.
Odenak was very different than, what I was saying before. Mainly, traditions of basket making was very much alive, and every house you went to, there was a woman making baskets with ash, splint, and they would dye them different colors, and they would hang them on the line, and I just love looking at that, and sweet grass. So the odor in every house was just so comforting. So wonderful, and that I miss that, because it's not like that anymore. There's a few basket makers still, but it's not like before where everybody was busy making baskets. And the men were making canoes, and they were guides in the bush, for hunting and fishing. So it was a very different atmosphere, and a lot of people spoke the language at that time. And a lot of people spoke three languages, French, English, and Abenaki. So we didn't have electricity, so we had oil lamps, and at night we heard the adults talking about their experience and stories and history. It was very different, and I think this is the reason why I always, before making a film, I tape people just with sound, and I like to listen to people with no distraction. Such as a camera or anything like that. And I listen to what they have to say about themselves, and I don't want any interference. And I only come back with the crew later. And for me, the word is so important.
You went to school as a little girl in a school that had no other Indigenous people. You were the only one in your class.
Yes.
What was that like?
It was awful. It's one part of my life that I... it was just very bad, like I was made to feel inferior and excluded and all that stuff. And it was from the teaching, that of... of about our people in the history, which was so degrading and oppressive and racist. And it's amazing because learning places are so important. And if you're there and you're learning to hate, there's something very wrong for one's life. And that was what was happening at that time. This is why I started finding ways of influencing changes in terms of education and wanting a better place for our children.
So you obviously were made to feel less than in school,
yeah.
But then you ended up doing the opposite, advocating for your people, yeah. And having a lot of pride. So
yeah.
How did that, where did you find that pride from, or what did you just from your family it stayed instilled in you that, you know?
Well, I don't call it pride. I don't think pride is a quality. I think it's mainly to find yourself and understand the values of what you are and those feelings that I work with children all the time. And never tell them enough that how important they are and how beautiful they are. And it's very important when you're in a classroom, instead of being thrown out or made to feel that you should be invisible, well, it's not good for any child. And those are the kinds of things that I spend a lot of time trying to making sure it doesn't happen.
And in the 60s, when you started to sing and dance and be asked to come and perform at various places in schools, and you were really teaching about your own culture, this was during a time when, I guess, that, you know, when Indigenous people got the vote in 1960, it was kind of a little bit of an accomplishment, or it felt like
mm-hmm.
like a step forward.
Yeah.
Although a lot of Indigenous people don't vote in elections
no.
and don't agree with voting
no.
and consider
no.
it even trade, yeah. you know, you're a traitor if you vote. But so did that, was that, did you see that happen in the 60s, that all of a sudden Indigenous people, there was a fascination perhaps with them in the wider culture?
No, I think it was still very racist here, you know.
Oh.
And it took a while. And, you know, Quebec never gave the right to vote until 1969. And these things, people don't realize what that means. And
so they were the last to give women
yeah,
the vote, and then
yeah.
they were the last to give Indigenous people the vote.
Yeah, yes.
Wow.
It's interesting.
But you weren't just traveling in Quebec, right? You were also...
Oh, no, all over the country.
And in
the
U.S.
In the States
as well.
And in Europe, too. I've been in a lot of places. And I've had such fantastic relation with children of all ages, from kindergarten to university. And I love it. I still do it whenever I can.
And you know, Canada is celebrating its 150th birthday this year. And I've actually interviewed other Indigenous people on my show, and I often ask them this question, you know, well, what does it mean to you, Canada's 150th birthday?
Well, it's 150 of lives, and I think it's important to make sure that Canadians understand what the true story is, and that we have to tell it, and that's it, and there has to be changes. And there's a lot of things happening. I'm very, very happy to see the efforts in a lot of things, in a lot of ways. And, you know, especially education, it's so important. And I see that across the country, a lot of the university population are really changing, making sure they have a real program, and they want to teach the languages, the traditions, and who are all those nations. And so it's changing a lot.
You know, you work for a government institution, the
yes.
National Film Board of Canada, and, you know, I do find that, you know, we're learning a lot about the truth through things like the National Film Board of Canada, things, you know, even the CBC.
Yes.
But there seems to be this, this disconnect between our politicians and what some of these institutions are telling us.
Yeah. It's always going to be like that. But there's also a lot of changes. You know, not all politicians or government people are bad people. There's a lot of good people who go in there wanting to make a difference. And a lot of them do. And some don't. So, but we have a big job ourselves to do, because we also are part of the leadership, and we have to not lie down, you know. You have to do everything you can as an individual. And politicians always feel that, oh, wow, they spend so much money. Yes, but if you don't spend what you're supposed to spend, then, you know, people are... the best example that I've been giving lately is when Cindy Blackstock explained in court that they were funded for 500 children, but they had 790 children to feed. And so the government can say, oh, but we spent all that money, but you right. didn't spend what should be coming right. to each child. Yeah. And it's like that in everything.
Yeah.
So there's something wrong with not giving what's needed, but just partly. It doesn't work. And who suffers? It's the children. And that has to change.
You've talked a number of times about how inspiring it is to see some of the youth of today.
Yes.
For example, in your film Trick or Treaty, the youth that are doing these huge marches to Ottawa, from
amazing.
Great distances. Tell me a little bit about
that. Yeah, I'm very, very impressed with young people. And, we think that prophecies are coming true. That we are always told, oh, the seventh generation is going to be the one that's going to save our people. And there's those kids marching, and the way they talk is just so incredible. So beautiful. So devoted and responsible, and I'm very impressed.
Do you think that's partly because this is the generation that is maybe the most removed from the generation that had to deal with the residential schools?
They're certainly learning a lot and understanding their parents better as we're going along every day now. A lot of the problems and the trouble, and some people have repeated what's done, what has been done to them. It's very hard for children to understand, but now we have a generation who say, I was angry at my parents because of what they did. And now it's a different talk, like they all of a sudden realize an understanding that they didn't have before of their parents and their ancestors, and knowing the history and wanting to really help make the change. I find young people very responsible in general. And I'm just so touched by that.
And in terms of the filmmaking process for you, when you were younger, making some of your first films at the National Film Board compared to now, and because you're so well established now, has it gotten easier, the process?
Yes. Yeah, it was very hard at the beginning, in every way, everything. But, a place like the National Film Board of Canada is extraordinary. It's incredible that we have that in our country. I travel all the time and many places in the States, they don't have such an institution. And it's hard for filmmakers to function and to say what they wish to say and all that. And I am very happy that I have had a chance to work there. And what it stands for, it's a mandate that I feel so extraordinary about for Canada. And sometimes you go, you get unhappy or you don't like what's happening. It's individual people who do that, not the mandate of the board. The board is there for a very good reason. And it's to tell Canada to Canadians and the world. And that's what we're doing.
And I once heard that the National Film Board had probably the largest collection of indigenous-based
Yeah,
films in the world.
I would think so.
So that's
Yes.
quite something,
Yes.
yeah. Are you nervous about the eventual move from the old location
No, I think it'll be wonderful. I saw a photograph. It looked like a sculpture to me, looking up to the sky. It's beautiful.
Because a lot of us, I guess, are nervous that it's another way to downsize the place.
Well, it's been downsized, you know.
This is Ryan Young with CKUT 90.3 FM, and I'm here with Alanis Obabsawin, who is a documentary filmmaker working for the National Film Board of Canada. I don't want to take any more of your time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, I'm glad I came.
Welcome, everybody. This is CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Benjamin Scree, reporting for John Abbott on the Air. And today we have a good one for you. I went out to interview a local game developer in the Montreal area. I actually spoke to him a bit beforehand, and he was talking to me about his new project. And I asked him if he was going to come on the show, or if he wanted to, and he accepted. So I'm excited to hear him talk about his new project. So I'm here today with the wonderful, the amazing Kum Pavlov, and he's here to talk about his new game. So, Kum, first of all, how are you?
I'm feeling pretty well. What about you?
I'm doing all right. I was just wondering, because you were talking about your project that you were working on earlier. What are you actually working on?
Okay, well, so me and my friend Samuel are together are working towards making a game, more specifically an RPG video game, a turn-based RPG.
Okay, what is an RPG? Because there's a lot of people who don't necessarily
Right,
understand what that means.
right, right. So, an RPG is basically just take Dungeons and Dragons or chess and convert that into video game characters. So the characters are the pawns, and you have very different moves that you can do to eliminate your enemy. And basically, the idea is to use strategy and different moves to gain an advantage in the field and win the battle, kind of like in chess.
Okay, how does the fighting system, or I guess the RPG element, come into effect in your game? Like, why is it important?
It's an important system because the battles that will be done will also include things, random hazards that can happen in real life, such as someone getting stunned, or someone tripping, or someone getting tired, or someone bleeding out, things like this.
So your game is inspired on real life events, or what could happen?
Yes, it's inspired on real life events. So you could say that it's basically chess with extra steps.
Okay. Since it's based on real life, is there a specific story next to it, or is it just like someone living?
It is for the biggest part, it's fiction, most of it. Except some of the characters are based on real life people, but they're not said people. So to make it easier for us, so we focus more on the gameplay than like making a story, we used the people we knew, and we gave the characters their appearance as well as some of their personality traits that are the most common. So to make it easier for us to get a quick setup for a story, since we would already know how they're going to be acting like, which will make it easier for us to make the story, and therefore we can focus more on the game aspect of the video game.
Who are these people like based upon? Because you said they were based on certain.
Yeah, so most of them are just friends or close ones, or people that we knew, like not necessarily friends, can also be acquaintances, as long as they have something that could contribute to the game or the story.
Okay, well, how do these people actually interact in the story? Are they all going to be important?
No, not necessarily. Some of them would just be NPCs, non-playable characters that are just simply there as like background characters. Some of them do actually play a very important role in the story, such as even going as far as secondary characters or even main characters could be based on people that we knew.
Okay, so what is the plot of the game? Because it's based on real life events with people you know. So what is it actually about?
Well, it's not really based on real life events per se. It's mostly, at this point, it's not really based on real life events. It's an amalgamation of several events and anecdotes that several people told us mixed into just one big experience.
Do you have the story already figured out? Is the story already all figured out?
We're getting there. Not really. We know the general picture. We get the general picture of what the story is going to be. But when it comes to like specific events and details, we're still working on that. It's not done yet.
Okay, you're still in very early stages, basically.
Yeah, it's still very early to really say with confidence that, yes, our story is 100% done.
Okay, have you started designing any of the characters, or they're still brainstorming?
Yes, I did. I started designing one character for now, I am designing one of them. We were planning on making more of them. I'm actually the one in charge of the visuals and the animations. Sam is in charge of the programming. I'm making one character. I have to animate him. It takes a lot of time since I'm doing this by myself. So, yes. But for the others, we still don't really have any ideas of what they're going to... Well, we know what they're going to look like, but we don't know their clothing, what it's going to look like. So I'll have to make that up once I'm finished with the current one.
Okay. You said that basically it takes a lot of time since you're doing it by yourself. Well, is there any other challenges to being a small team developing a video game, or that's really the big thing?
The lack of resources, one. The second thing is that we don't have many perspectives because we're only two. Maybe us, we see this. Maybe, like, let's say we look at the story. The two of us are like, yeah, this is really good. Maybe through the eyes of other people, they're going to be like, well, this is horrible. Oh, my God.
Because how are you finding other people's opinion? Or are you actually looking for other people's opinion?
I am asking people around what they think would be good for a story like this, what other people would add to the story, or is there anything that's missing, or could we elaborate on something else? So yes, we're definitely asking feedback from people, and yeah, we're really open to any sort of criticism or even suggestions, because who knows how many of them we're gonna have until we're starting to run short on resources.
Your resources, do you mean like monetarily?
No, I mean like imagination, because sometimes we can run out of ideas for certain parts, or just some stuff just doesn't work and we have to rewrite something else. So because sometimes we think of something, then we're paralyzed and we don't know what to do. Then we ask someone else, and then this person says, well, why don't you just do this? And then we're like, okay, well, why didn't we think of that? This is another of the problems of only being two people, is that we lack other perspectives. We only have two perspectives. That's good, but sometimes it's not enough when you want to make a full-fledged video game.
That being said, do you think there will be any problems monetarily in the future? Or you feel pretty comfortable about that?
Well, I mean, I can't exactly say that we're rich. But at the same time, we're a low-budget team, but at the same time, the game itself doesn't cost that much. The equipment we're using is not that expensive, so...
Speaking of promoting, is there any place that people can find any information about the game? Any information, basically?
No, actually, not yet, since, again, we're in very, very early stages of development. We still don't even know what the game is going to look like visually. So there's not really any real sites or accounts that you can use. I'm planning on making an Instagram account or a Twitter account where I actually post, or even on YouTube where I just post some art or updates of the game and how it's going.
All right. Well, thank you. We'll definitely try to update people on that and try to make them find a way to actually look at your game and, like you said, give you like some criticisms or some feedback.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for being on.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. That was Kum Pavlov working on his new project. Now, unfortunately, he did tell us that there's no information online at the moment, but he is telling us that he was going to work on that. So we will make sure to update you guys. I'm Benjamin Screeve reporting for John Abbott on the air on CKUT 90.3 FM.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is John Abbott on the air. I'm Evie Stockvist. See you next time. Happy birthday to you, joyeux anniversaire, samedi midi et terre. Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you, joyeux anniversaire, samedi midi et terre.
Yeah, André. Ça c'est comme tu fais, mais on vous attendre.
Fêter, 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 na fêter, viens poudre, en nous célébrer.